WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We all know what circus music sounds like, but we're about to hear some circus music that doesn't sound like that at all. It's music commissioned by the Cirque Valentine Circus of Moscow. My guest is the composer, Bobby Previtt. Previtt is also a drummer. In 1991, Rolling Stone named him Hot Jazz Artist of the Year, and in the accompanying entry, Steve Futterman described Previtt's drumming as extraordinary. He wrote, "Previtt came to Manhattan in 1980 and quickly became the drummer of choice for the alternative downtown scene." Tomorrow night, as part of Philadelphia's Mellon Jazz Festival, the Relâche Ensemble will perform his work. Previtt's latest album is his music for the Moscow Circus. All of the music is original, except this. He couldn't resist getting in the classic march, Thunder and Blazes, but he does it as a ballad.
I had to write the music to each of the acts. You know, the acts were all done. They were all choreographed, and it's not like a dance even where you can change it. You know, these people, circus people are in a way very rigid, you know, with good reason. They have their act, and one split second off and they could be seriously injured, you know, so it's not a situation where you can go, can you just slow that movement down because it doesn't fit in with my arrangement, you know? So I knew that I had to get pretty close to what they were doing, you know?
Well, that's probably the first time that you had to worry in your composing about somebody breaking their neck if you did something inappropriate.
It was kind of a burden, you know? I was going, my God, if I write something like that sounds, that takes somebody by surprise, like what's going to happen? They're going to fall or what? So it was pretty wild, but I just, you know, full speed ahead, and I figured they would have to deal with it, you know.
Now, what kind of act were you writing for the second piece on your album, the Russian Bar?
Oh, that was it's a traditional, the Russian Bar are long, flexible bars, and their two men have them on their shoulders. They hold them on their shoulders. And then usually the women get on the bars and they get flipped way up in the air because it's flexible. You know, they bend down and they get zoomed up in the air at great heights and they flip and turn and they do all these things. Actually, it's one of the most dangerous acts in the circus. And it's a very traditional act in Russia. And actually, the traditional music has been very bombastic kind of sounding, and so I wanted to take it completely opposite direction, so I wrote a solo piano piece for it, which the director was astounded. He said, I don't think this is going to work, and I said, please, just watch it. And, I think it turned out to be one of his favorites.
Let me play some of this music that you wrote, The Russian Bar.
Okay.
So this music was not the kind of bombastic music that was expected. How did it change, do you think, the way the audience perceived the performance?
I think they saw it as much more internal and much more, you know, it was more delicate. And I think it gave it I think it brought out the dangerous aspect of it, because the music is kind of, you know, it has that delicate, fragile nature, you know, very spare. And, you know, when they're jumping in the air and landing on these bars, I put a lot of silences in there too, you know, for effect. And I think it just heightened the danger aspect of it. It was very beautiful. They had like tutus on, and they would be jumping, and they were beautiful ballerinas. They were two sisters. They were identical twins, and they were like, one of them was the champion gymnast of Europe. They were very young, and they were very good. And I think that's what it did. It just made it a little tenser and a little more internalized, which I wanted.
Did any of the performers, after they heard what you wrote for them, say, I can't do my act to this, I'm sorry?
Did any of them?
Would they all say that?
Pretty much, yeah. But, you know, we prevailed, you know, upon them. A couple of them, you know, as I said before, you have to understand, first of all, they don't get to hear that much. You know, they're living in a country that's not exactly, you know, doesn't have exactly a wide range of choice at that time, and a couple of them really got it immediately, said, yeah, this is okay, you know. But a couple of them were very, you know, tough nuts to crack, and we really had to work and say, no, listen, just listen to it and just move with it. And then I think they discovered there was something in it, you know, and that it ultimately, hopefully, was better than the, you know, the canned music they had been using. Because the music they had been using really didn't really speak to the emotional tenor of what they were doing, you know.
So you think they're sold on it now?
Oh, I wouldn't go that far, but it was also created for the specific set of musicians, and those musicians have kind of been dispersed, and I'm not sure if it's ever really going to be performed again. It probably won't be, so they may have to go back to their music they were using before.
I see. You know, I think some of the most kind of wild and avant-garde moments on this is the stuff you wrote for the clowns. It's really terrific stuff.
That is actually the most fun I've ever had in a studio in my life, doing those little clown music bursts. There's about six or seven of them, I think. And that was a big decision whether to put them all together on the record or intersperse them, kind of, which I ultimately decided to do because I wanted to keep the circus flavor of the record. But, that was all done in 20 minutes. All those clown cuts were just 20 minutes, and we were literally laughing so hard we could hardly play. In fact, on the 2-inch tape, you can hear us just, we would hit the floor after we played each of those.
How composed were these, or was it more directions to the performers?
Some of the tunes are, of course, very through composed. I mean, they're totally, every note is written, but those clown musics are very, very improvisatory. I mean, I said, I had all these sounds on the sampler, you know, these traditional circus music sounds sampled, and I had them brought up on a keyboard. So I had a keyboard player, Steve Gabouri, a trumpeter, Herb Robertson, and myself. And I would just sort of say, okay, march. We're going to do a march. Okay, what's the key? E flat. Okay, ready? Roll tape. Go. And we would just do it, and we would end when we ended, you know. And I said, I want them all to be short. Okay, fine. Now we're going to do a waltz. and that's how we did those. Sometimes you have to do things like that. You get results that you could never, ever get had you sat down and said, okay, now let's see, G flat, now what do I, you know, had you wrote it down in a very linear fashion, you know.
Let's hear some of this clown music. Okay. And this is from Bobby Previtt's album Music of the Moscow Circus. From the album Music of the Moscow Circus, and my guest is composer and drummer Bobby Previtt. Now, I know that you were in Moscow rehearsing with the circus. and the circus band during the attempted coup. When did the coup happen in relationship to your work?
Well, I had been there, let's see, about 7 or 8 days. I had a day and a half left, or 2 days left. And, well, I had this, I was in the Hotel Russia, which is this huge, they have these huge hotels there, you know, 2,000 rooms with a bar on every floor. You know, that's the kind of thing they have there. And it was just opposite of Red Square. And I used to, my drill was that I would, my driver and my interpreter would come in the morning, and she would call me. I would come down. She would have breakfast with me, because otherwise I couldn't order anything, because I would starve. And we would, you know, look out over Red Square. So, you know, that morning of the coup, we were having breakfast, and I'm looking out over Red Square, and I suddenly say, what's that? What are those? You know? And we're like, oh, those are tanks. And so we sort of said, yeah. And when we got in the car, we would start driving through the city, and it was really amazing, because then we saw the streets were blocked with tanks and all kinds of armored vehicles, and then there were these certain buildings that were just ringed with tanks. And I would always say, well, what's that building? And she would say, TAS. And then the next one would be Izvestia, and the next one would be Pravda. Every information, building where information was disseminated was surrounded by tanks. It's pretty amazing. And so I guess we figured something was up. And then when we got to the circus office, we found out that there had been a coup and Gorbachev was deposed and, you know.
So was your instinct, let me out of here?
No, my instincts run a lot more self-destructive than that. My instinct was, wow, this is great. This is really fascinating. No, it was really kind of exciting. I mean, I wanted to find out about it and to be in the middle of a coup. It was kind of, you know, I mean, it was a little bit threatening. But I had work to do, and I really needed the last day, because that was the day we were putting a lot of the music with the performers, you know. And that was precious time. So I stayed to do the work, you know. But then when I had to leave, of course, was the worst day, because it was the curfew, you know.
Well, I'm thinking what this must have been like. You're testing out your new music with these really dangerous acts, worrying that somebody's going to break their neck while performing to your new music. Meanwhile, the coup's going on. So, of course, if their concentration isn't at its utmost, it has as much to do with the coup as with the music. So it must have been pretty strenuous in there.
Yeah, it was a pretty wild day and a half, I must say. We were, we worked 12 hours that day. And then when I finally got back, you know, I had to say my goodbyes to everybody. And, of course, then, you know, my interpreter came with me, and I had a 6 a.m. flight from Moscow. I was going to Sardinia, and I had a concert to play. And, she watched television. She was watching the guy, and she said, guess what? I said, what? What could be wrong? She said, they just called a curfew. I said, oh, no, nobody on the street after 11 o'clock. And I said, but my flight is at 6:15. You know, how am I going to? She said, well, I don't know, basically. And, they tried to get me a car, and only official cars could go on the street. It was a mess. It took me 6 hours to get a car. And I finally got the car at 3 in the morning, and we got in it, and I had to, you know, make my deal with the driver. I had to bribe the driver, of course, but I was prepared. I said, look, I have lira, I have Deutschmarks, I have Finnmarks, dollars, rubles, what do you want? And we started on our way. We got through the KGB check, which is around the first corner, and I thought everything was fine, except that we turned a corner and 5 tanks blocked us, and, we came to a sputtering halt. Have you ever seen a modern tank, Terry?
Only on TV.
Yeah, wow. They're pretty big. They are very big. And, they came out with their guns drawn, and, you know, it was exciting. Yeah. And they wouldn't let me through, actually.
So the guards finally let you through.
Well, I had to go to another, you know, he started to take me back to the hotel. And I said, where are we going? No, 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 this is not right. I have to get to the airport. I mean, I have a gig.
Oh, yeah, like I really care. You have a gig.
And I said, you got to get me to the airport to her. I said, she said, okay, okay. Now, this woman was kind of a little bit like Natasha and Bullwinkle, you know remember her?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then she says, okay, do not worry. I will get you out, you know, she said to me. Are you nervous? Do not be nervous. Just don't do anything. Don't say anything. Do not move. Do not. I said, listen, just I'm fine. Just get me out. I won't. Because I said, should I show my passport? Should I get out of the car? No, no. Do not move. You know, all right, all right. So finally, she talked the driver into making this in series of turns and bends down these back roads. And we got to another roadblock. And I don't know, somehow they let us through that one. And I got to the airport. And this woman literally pushed me out the gate because I was in this tremendous line. And, you know, they have a whole line psychology there that we cannot understand. You have to let some people through and some people you can cut in front of and it's okay. I mean, I didn't understand it, but she pushed me out the gate finally. She had her hand on my back as I went out with my baggage.
Did you make it to the gig on time?
Yeah, I did. Haven't missed one yet.
It's amazing. Even a coup and he shows up. If you're just joining us, my guest is composer and drummer Bobby Previtt. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Bobby Previtt is my guest. You grew up in Niagara Falls.
I did.
How were you introduced to jazz?
Actually, you know, this friend of mine, Billy Savino, introduced me to jazz. You know, he played me some, you know, records, John Coltrane and, you know, Miles Davis. And that's really was my first introduction. And then, of course, you know, I took it from there.
Were you already playing drums?
Yeah, I had been playing drums for years. We've been playing together, and we had this six-piece band, you know, and half of them quit, the singing, songwriting half. So the only thing left was the rhythm section, music half, and I thought that was the end of the band, of course, and he said, no, we could still play, and I said, how can we play? We don't have a singer. And he said, well, we don't need a singer. We can just play music. And I went, wow, we can play music. So that's the way it started, that I realized that you could actually play music without having a singer. And it was quite a revelation.
Now, I'm sure you were exposed to different kinds of music in Buffalo. I know in the 70s there was really quite a new music scene there, avant-garde music. Did you listen to a lot of that, and do you think it had an impact on you?
Oh, definitely had an impact. I used to go to the evenings for new music at the Albright Knox and, you know, listen to Lucas Foss and Jan Williams, my percussion teacher. And, oh, yeah, because it showed me that there was a world way beyond what I had known, just for that. You know, it's sort of that there were people making music that was so far removed from my idea about what music was. It was thrilling, and it was really liberating, even if ultimately I sort of rejected that path. It was very liberating for me. That's what it did for me. Just said, look at this, and you can do whatever you want.
So when you left Buffalo, what was your impetus to leave? Was there a turning point where you said, okay, now I really have to go?
Yeah, actually there was, because I had put on this concert in downtown Buffalo. I produced a whole concert series, a weekend concert of all my favorite musicians in Buffalo, and it was very inexpensive. It was in a beautiful theater, and it was downtown. There wasn't anything else happening that weekend. It was beautiful weather, great music, you know, three bands for the price of one, and very few people came. And I thought, well, you know, I had a lot of publicity for it, and I just thought, well, I just guess I just gonna have to leave because there's just not enough of an audience here for what I wanted to do, you know. And that sort of cinched it for me.
So you went to New York?
Well, where else? I mean, for the kind of music I wanted to play, this was really the only place to go because, you know, Los Angeles was more the music industry, and I think it's more, you know, films, television, and rock and roll music. So for, you know, the kind of stuff that I was interested in, really, New York was the only place.
What is the worst gig you've ever played?
Oh, my gosh. The worst gig I ever played, one of the worst gigs I ever played was I got a call for a disco band, and since I wasn't doing anything, they said, please, Bobby, we know you don't play disco, but we know you learn really fast. We got this really important gig, and our drummer quit. I said, okay, so I had to learn 30 tunes in a day, you know, with arrangements, and you wouldn't believe, I mean, you know, horns and everything. So we got this gig, and it was like their big important gig. It was 100 miles outside of Buffalo, and they had roadies and lights, and they brought all my drums, but they forgot all my hardware, you see. So I had no hi-hat. I mean, you ever try to play a disco gig with no hi-hat? It's very difficult, let me tell you. And I had no cymbal stand, so they had to suspend the cymbals from the ceiling, and they were moving all over, and I was about to get decapitated at any moment, and my drums were all on chairs, and they were cueing me. I didn't know the music, and then they had put one of the lights too close to my bass drum, and it had burned my bass drum, and this noxious fumes came up and almost choked me to death, and that was all in the first 10 minutes. It went downhill from there. That was one of the worst gigs I ever played.
Oh, but you really liked the music, right?
besides, I had a right. I said, well, never again. I've played some really, I played a job in a bar in downtown Buffalo, a heavy drinking bar. I hadn't had music in 25 years. And they moved the pool table. It was the first time the pool table had been moved in 25 years. Now, you can imagine, for us, right? You can imagine how this went over, right? And in the corner, there was a guy, and he took out a switchblade as I was setting up, and he started picking his teeth with it. And he said to me, are you guys any good? And I said, well, you know, we're pretty good, I guess. And he said, because if you guys aren't any good, Johnny's going to kill you. So anyway, I'm here, so I guess we did all right. But yeah, there's a million of those stories, too. Oh,
Bobby, it's great to talk to you.
You too, Tara.
Take care.
Okay, I'll see you sometime.
Bobby Previtt's latest album is Music of the Moscow Circus on Gramavision Records. Let's listen to some of Previtt's non-circus music. This is Photo Finish from his recent album, Weather Clear, Track Fast. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.